Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with biographer John Lahr, whose new book is Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh. He will be a special guest at this week's Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. It's a great pleasure today to talk with John Lahr, whose amazing new biography is Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh, which recently received the National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography. John Lahr is also the author of Prick Up Your Ears, a biography of Joe Orton, as well as a memoir, Notes from a Cowardly Lion, about his father, the actor Burt Lahr. The longtime senior drama critic for The New Yorker, he is also the only theater critic to have won a Tony Award. That was in 2002 for his part in writing Elaine Stritch at Liberty. And John Lahr will be one of the headliners at this year's Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. He is speaking to us from his home in London. John, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, nice to be with you.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to have you. Now, this book has such an interesting history of its own, and I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about Lyle Leveridge, the author of Tom, the Unknown Tennessee Williams, who asked you to pick up where he left off.
Well, it's somewhat a long story, but I will tell it. In 1984, because of the success of Notes on a Caroline, but primarily Prick Up Your Ears, which had been out a couple of years and had been a sort of cult book, the Williams estate contacted me to write his authorized biography. And I went down to Austin, Texas, where the University of Texas's archive, Williams archive is, and looked at the material, thought it was great, but it was massive. And I had a six-year-old son, and I lived in London, and there was just no way I could do it. So I shined it on, as they say. I passed. And only later did I realize that why they had contacted me was that they thought that if they could announce that I was doing the biography of Williams, that all the theatrical people would, because I was a named figure in the theatrical world, would talk to me and would drive out the carpetbagger called Lyle Leveridge, who was a theater producer from San Francisco who had never written a biography, whom Tennessee, in his wisdom, had given, he said, oh, baby, you write my biography, and gave him two, not one, but two letters of authorization to do that. And I thought nothing of it. It was just too bad, missed opportunity. And cut to 1994, and I'm at The New Yorker, the senior drama critic at The New Yorker, and Lyle Leveridge, the man that I'd never met, that I had been enticed to force off the field, came to see me, and he had a problem. And his problem was simple and terrible. He had written a book called Tom, and it was being prevented from being published. Williams was then and is now the absolute number one bestseller of his publishing house, which is New Directions. And the founder and publisher of New Directions, James Laughlin, had been established as the person to vet the manuscript, and he pronounced the manuscript not worthy of publication. So the person who had sort of engineered both Laughlin to do that, had been the sort of stirring the pot in all this, was a woman called Lady Maria St. Just, who was the soi-disant executor of Williams's estate. And Lyle had some information about her. And he asked me if I would write a profile in The New Yorker with the spotlight, turn the spotlight on the sort of caprice of the estate in order to liberate his book. He couldn't afford to take her to court. He couldn't do anything. He'd done like 10 years' work. And I, being a biographer, was also in my own area, using the New Yorker as a bully pulpit to argue the case for Williams's excellence. It's just as Lyle was trying to do with his biography, Tom, which really took him up to, until he became known as Tennessee, really after the success of Glass Menagerie in 1945. So, as of today, I've written about 40 profiles in the New Yorker, more than 40. And this profile was my first, so it was a long time ago.
Wow.
And Lyle gave me the information, and I went and did about 3 months reporting. In the interim, Lady Maria died, but leaving Lyle in an impossible position. And I did my research, and had she lived, I could have put her in jail. I had her on fiduciary responsibility, extortion. And what had happened, as much out of ignorance as vindictiveness, I think, is that a number of things had happened. First of all, she had prevented the University of Texas from Xeroxing or allowing critics to quote from his work because she believed that they should pay for that privilege. She had stopped not only Lyle's biography, but she had prevented another book, which was about Tennessee's late plays, which were numerous, but no one knew about them, from being published. So those two books are stopped. And his last really quite good play, called House Not Meant to Stand, which had had a fairly successful debut in Chicago and had been offered a New York production at Lincoln Center by the man who had originally produced it in Chicago, Greg Mosher. She had prevented that from happening, having never seen the production. Now, the cumulative effect of all that was that for the decade after his death in 1983, Williams' reputation flatlined because there was absolutely no discussion about him, no new information, no nothing. Now, the icing on the cake here, and the question was why Lyle's book had all sorts of new information, a great deal of things that had never been raised. Nobody knew about Williams, and nobody had access to use the material of his life, early life. Why that happened? And I was a senior dramaturg for The New Yorker for 21 years, and I never had a bad day at The New Yorker, but the best day I had at The New Yorker was the day that Lyle and I were in my office, and we had on the speakerphone James Laughlin, the founder and head of New Directions, on the telephone, and I asked him point blank why he had prevented the biography from being published. And he said, blackmail. And what,
wow.
Yeah, exactly, amazing. And Lyle and I were literally jumping up and down and high-fiving because this was the coup de grace. And what Maria had done was threatened to take away all the copyrights from New Directions, all the Williams copyrights, which is the money tree of New Directions, which allows them to publish all those Iranian poets and Polish novelists. And what they did is the estate spun it, and to give this rather appalling story a happy ending, they said that Lyle's book could be published. So one of the very proudest moments of my tenure at The New Yorker was to liberate this book for publication.
I love that story.
That's what it did.
After Leverich's death, you gathered up the remaining materials, but you definitely took your own approach to the biography by grappling with the way the plays were written.
I had a point of view about the plays and his life. I was looking for things. Lyle was fishing for things. He didn't have a point of view about the plays. I wanted to tell the story of how the plays got written, because I'm a theater historian, and that, because Lyle wasn't that and wasn't a critic, those elements didn't come into his net. He was really just wanted to map the actual sort of geography of the career, and I wanted to map the way the internal geography of the man is mirrored in the plays, which is what he, Williams, said he was doing, that the plays represented the climate of his interior at the time of the writing. So I figured if you really looked at the plays closely, as his heart sort of opened, flowered, ossified, and collapsed, the plays would dramatize that struggle and the issues, which indeed they do. So the synergy between the plays and the man was the thing I was going after. It's a completely other narrative challenge. And so that's why the book is not published as the second volume of Lyle's book, but as a standalone biography.
As it is, of course.
Yeah.
But it took you 12 years to write this book.
Well, I had a day job.
Yes, you did have a day job and a demanding one. But what was your point of human connection with Williams? I mean, this is like a long marriage, you know, 12 years.
Well, that's a very compassionate question. One of the things I like doing as a critic is, in my game is to change the discussion, to shift the discussion, to try to put another lens into one's glasses and see the plays in another way. Not that it's made up, it's in the plays, but usually in the culture, there's a narrative that gets established through journalism that just continues and continues, and the artists are frozen in the aspect of it. So, for instance, when you talk about Williams, immediately the discussion is about sexuality. And, of course, that is central to Williams. But there's something else that he dramatizes because he's a hysteric and he's really putting his insides out. And what he makes dynamic on stage and palpable on stage is absence, the sense of a present absence. And that may sound a little sort of arty-farty, but anybody who's had a parent who was there and not there, as I did, we'll know what that is. We are, all of us, haunted in some way. Mm-hmm. And these hauntings, the spectral quality of Williams, resonates with my father and, in fact, my family. And also, I would say, the other thing that I appreciate in Williams, over and above the lyricism and the humor, we have very few words for pain. It's sort of indescribable. And I think I admire the way he defines, he finds a way in his plays of trapping and demonstrating how we suffer.
And you're especially pleased by what you discovered about Elia Kazan's influence on Williams' work.
I suppose the one single most sort of glaring surprise was how important Elia Kazan was, not to just the success of the plays as staged, but to the writing of the plays and to pushing Williams well beyond his comfort zone to be his best literary self. I don't think now, having done the book, that we would be sitting here talking about Tennessee Williams' oeuvre without Kazan, because Kazan did not direct The Rose Tattoo, but he gave Williams the outline from which to write the final draft. He took an absolute melange of scenes and organized them into a structure to make Camino Real. He gave Cattle on a Hot Tin Roof, which Williams thought was a one-act play and wanted to do as a one-act play, and who wrote Big Daddy into two acts and never brought him into a third act. He gave that a shape and a coherence and a power that was never in the original draft, which was good. But what he told Williams, don't rush to do this, hold back. He solved visually the problem of Sweet Bird of Youth. He finessed it with his own expertise because Williams never really satisfactorily wrote a good second act to the play. He had a first and a third act, which were great, real strong. So that the whole of From Streetcar on to Sweet Bird, that's the bulk of Williams' work. There are a few moonlighting assignments from other directors, but basically it's all Kazan. And the minute he broke with Kazan after that, although he did have a hit with Night of the Iguana, Williams really never had another substantial hit or any director who he trusted enough to surrender to. And as a consequence, his work became much more disorganized as it would have been without Kazan. And it would have been good. It was not that he couldn't do the job. It was just that the Kazan sharpened it and honed it and made it work with audiences.
And then, of course, we'd love to hear about Williams' strong feelings about New Orleans.
He loved New Orleans. It was where he claimed his sexual and his literary identity. That's enough. he mythologized it in a number of plays, but of course Streetcar especially is this sensual,
yes,
funky, rich, emotional, louche life. You know, he made it fabulous. It is fabulous.
It is fabulous.
Yeah, and it's also very other.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, it's freer. And so it's part of his myth, but I think myself that Williams wanted to shake the Southern writer thing. He couldn't keep writing plays in a Southern idiom, so a lot of the plays, like I'm thinking of The Rose Tattoo and Orpheus Descending, they're set in the South, but they don't have a Southern voice, you know, in the same way they have Italian voices. I mean, obviously, Rose Tattoo is not set in the South, it's set in Italy. But what I mean is, the attempt is to, I think, to throw his voices farther afield.
And, you know, I don't think I ever fully got Tennessee Williams until I read this book. I really do feel like you've given us the man in full. The horror of his family life, that final insult of Dakin's choice of burial place, and, you know,
I know. It's such a sort of sibling rivalry and the revenge of it.
And the desperation of his sex life. He played all that out in public. Do you think that playwrights now will ever be the kind of celebrities that Williams was?
They could be. I mean, you know, esteem is awarded on evidence. You have to do the work to have that kind of influence. And there are people out there. Each person is unique, but there are writers who are in our time who have played as crucial a part in shaping the consciousness of their time. I mean, I would say Pinter has in England, for instance.
Right.
Beckett has. In America, I think Williams has, partially because the plays, I mean, in his golden period, he wrote 11 plays and 19 films. You'd have to say he was the most popular storyteller of the post-war period. I mean, in terms of the penetration of the stories into the culture. There's nobody else that was a playwright who did any, you know, but part of that is output.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't even talked about the short stories and the poems.
And the poems, yes.
Yeah, which are actually grossly underrated. They're very good.
I know, I love them.
But it's hard to say, because generally speaking, especially now when movies are dumbing down, although I'm not a fan of Williams' films in general, because they do dumb him down and change his meaning, they still, in their time, I remember seeing them, and they still were challenging the public. But challenge is something that seems to have gone out of most cinema going now, in America anyway.
Right. But I remember once, I think Kenneth Holditch told me, he said, you know, everywhere, every night, somewhere in the world, someone is either watching a production of Streetcar Named Desire or watching the movie.
Well,
and, you know,
I certainly think one of the satisfying things for those like Lyle and me who were out there trying to beat the drum for Williams over the last couple of decades is that the effect of, you know, New Directions publishing regime and the biographies and the other, the notebooks and letters. The general effect is that this year, I think Williams's royalty check will be in the area of $1.5 million.
Wow.
So he's earning more now than he was a decade ago. It's on the increase. And all over the world.
So sad, like Elvis, you know.
to a degree, I think that's true. And my hope with the biography is that if you throw up more information or a way of seeing, it helps directors and actors to sort of take on the parts and give energy to things, or maybe even to find other plays that may not be great plays. I mean, I think that the one great play that has been overlooked almost, I mean, entirely, is a short play called The Gnadiger's Fräulein, which was on Broadway, which I saw, which is his only Theater of the Absurd play, an Ionesco-type play, when he was trying to figure out how to reach the audience.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about actors, I want to ask you one question. You're married to the American actress, Connie Booth,
correct.
She has actually performed in one of Williams' plays.
That's right, and very good she was, too. She was Laura in an early 70s production of
Menagerie. People talk so much about Williams' women. How did you all talk about that? Did she read your work as you wrote it? I mean, did you talk?
No, but we've been together now 25 years, and when we started courting, that was something we talked about Williams a lot, just talked. You know, and also because she's now a psychotherapist and we talk about families and children and the nature of psychodynamics. I mean, it's a very rich area of psychoanalytic and psychotherapeutic conversation. So it was ongoing, but of course she would read chapters and stuff. But, you know, like it is in a marriage, it's a conversation. And she might disagree with the valence of sentences or approach. You're too heavy on this or you're... You know, but it was basically, we're both just fascinated with Williams. And so it was fun. It was always fun to reflect on him. And, you know, the thing that broke me out, that really took me into a new area, was Williams said that he was the definition of hysteria. And once I understood hysteria and this sort of presenting symptoms of hysteria, I saw that that's really what Williams was writing about, and that those behaviors were the behaviors that he was exhibiting in his plays. And in a sense, the very way he wrote and his intention were, you know, to use his wound as a lure to attract attention and startle and astonish and control. That's a hysterical maneuver. That's the maneuver of a hysteric. And, you know, in Sweetbird, at the end of the play, Chance Wayne steps out of the story and comes downstage and says to the audience, "I'm not asking for your pity, just for your recognition of me in you." And that is what hysterics do. They project into others their feelings and their stuff, their emotional stuff. And that dynamic is absolutely central to what Williams did. But once I understood that, I was off to the races.
You have this lovely, magnificently written conclusion to your book, and you have this sentence, "Out of his sad little wish to be loved, Williams made characters so large that they became part of American folklore." I wonder why you call it the sad little wish to be loved.
Oh, that's funny that you said that, because I think it's the elemental. To be loved seems to be the simplest.
The big wish, thing. I mean, to me.
No, well, I mean, it should be given automatically, and it's a sad that you have to have.
Ah. Well, what a life. What a life that you've written.
He may have been tormented, but he lived at a level of torment and accomplishment that is almost impossible to imagine now. He was Promethean in some kind of crazy way. Promethean is intake of drugs. Promethean is ability to work. Promethean is sexual appetite. And his trajectory, the trajectory of his life from this sort of little nervous, shy, button-down, proper creature to this kind of wonderful lyric poet. He will, you know, in the very opening of the book, in the frontispiece of the book, I reproduce that page from his own copy of Hart Crane, where he says, "I feel more and more the need to become a savage." And the fact of that, how he managed to take his life and unlearn repression and claim his literary and sexual identity, it is a kind of heroic story. And it's just huge how far he traveled in his life.
Well, you do him honor in this book. It's a truly great book. It made me laugh, made me cry. It's just everything you want a book to be. So,
from your mouth to God's ears.
Well, we've been talking with John Lahr, whose magnificent new biography is Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh. He's appearing several times at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for the complete listing. But don't miss his onstage interview with Dr. Robert Bray, Sunday, March 29th at 10 at the Queen Anne Ballroom at the Hotel Monteleon. Thank you so much, John. It's been such a pleasure.
And for me.
Hey,
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. James Grissom signs Follies of God, Tennessee Williams and the Women of the Fog, Tuesday, March 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. N.K. Jemisin, who's been nominated for the Hugo, the Nebula, and the World Fantasy Award, signs her Inheritance trilogy, as well as The Killing Moon and The Shadowed Sun, Tuesday, March 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Kim Cross signs What Stands in a Storm, 3 days in the worst superstorm to hit the South's Tornado Alley, Wednesday, March 25th from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Edwin Garubo signs Sunday Pasta, A Year Around the Table with Family and Friends, Thursday, March 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. Terry Rappel discusses and signs Tai Chi American Style, Thursday, March 26th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Don't miss the yummy and gorgeous cakes at the Edible Book Day at the New Orleans Museum of Art, that annual baking competition for cakes inspired by favorite books. It takes place Friday, March 27th at 5:30 at the New Orleans Museum of Art, free with NOMA admission. Pat Roy reads from and signs The Beignet That Almost Got Away, Saturday, March 28th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Claire Louise Harmon reads from and signs The Thing Body, Sunday, March 29th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. This week, it's time to enjoy the 29th Annual Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, which takes place March 25th through 29th at the Hotel Montleon and many other venues around town. The complete schedule is up at the website tennesseewilliams.net. Special guests this year include today's guest, Williams biographer John Lahr, author of Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh, filmmaker John Waters, best-selling authors Laura Lippman, Rick Bragg, Amy Dickinson, Phil Cly, Yi-Yun Lee, and playwright Martin Sherman. And in addition to these well-established names, watch for Molly Antipol, LaShonda Catrice Barnett, Natalie Basile, Tom Cooper, Saeed Jones, Katie Simpson-Smith, Michael Ferris-Smith, Emma Walsh, and Michael Alenzell. And Thursday night, the Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction will be presented at the Beauregard Kai's House at 1313 Charter Street at 7 o'clock. The winners this year are Nevada Barr for Distinguished Body of Work for her long-running series featuring National Park Ranger Anna Pigeon, and Adrienne Herron, who will receive the Pinkley Prize for Debut Novel for A Man Came Out of the Door in the Mountain. Saints and Sinners, the literary festival for LGBT writers and friends, takes place next weekend as well in conjunction with the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Check out sasfest.org for the complete schedule. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will hold their semi-annual big book sale March 26th through 29th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Thursday through Saturday, March 26th through 28th from 10 to 8, and Sunday, March 29th from noon to 5. This is one of the largest book sales in the New Orleans area with more than 65,000 items for sale. And a big shout out to Tulane University professor Zachary Lazar, who received the John Updike Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters for his book, I Pity the Poor Immigrant. And Tulane professor Richard Campanella will receive the State Literary Award for his book, Bourbon Street, A History, at the Louisiana Library Association meeting in Shreveport, March 26th. Well done. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.